Hello, everyone. This is Cassie Burns, co-founder of All Your Data. I'm an attorney who's been using AI and machine learning for 10 years. I love data and love talking to people about data, and that's what this podcast is about. Each episode of Cassie and will feature a new guest. Each guest comes from a different background with a different approach and attitude towards technology. We'll talk about their experiences and hopefully we'll learn a thing or two. Thanks for joining. Let's get started with Cassie and
Rich Finkelman. Thank you so much for joining us here today, Rich.
The applause is tremendous.
Man, yeah, we'd like to show our guests how much we really appreciate you being here. Rich, you and I live in the same world that not many people know about, and it's called eDiscovery. And I know you've been in eDiscovery for a while in the legal tech world, so you're not one of my LinkedIn contacts. But let's tell the audience a little bit about yourself, Rich. Please do a better job maybe than I've just done.
Actually, we are LinkedIn contacts. Mm-hmm. That's Martha Lukes. Is it? I forget how to pronounce her last name. I think it's Lukes.
I think it's Lukes. Yes.
Okay. Anyway, I asked her to introduce us, and she did. And now here we are. Thanks for having me on your show. I'm a managing director at BRG. It's a consulting firm that some people know of and have heard of. You're right. I've been in eDiscovery for a very long time. I've run eDiscovery shops at other consulting firms. At BRG, I have my own eDiscovery group, and I'm also an AI expert, or at least they tell me at the firm I'm allowed to say that.
I mean, you're an AI visionary even, Rich, right?
Yeah, right. What a year. Actually, a year ago this coming week, I won Relativity's award for AI innovation, and then in January, they honored me with a 2024 AI visionary. So yeah, it's been
quite a
12 months. Look what you have on your podcast.
Man, it's season three is starting out very bright, I have to say. Now, Rich, I know we talk a lot. We have had quite a few very in-depth conversations. And I think something the AI has definitely highlighted to so many people, or at least the current focus on AI, is the importance of data. I think the layperson is increasingly aware of the importance of data. And we as eDiscovery professionals hold a bit of a unique role in data and client data. And I know you had heard a great phrase for it, and I'd love for you to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I did. I told you the other day that I'd been at a conference and I heard the term data steward being used as not specifically eDiscovery, but for people in corporations who have been put and generally tasked with things like information governance, records management, right? And the discussion was around how do you AI enable data? And I'll never forget the first data scientist that said to me, wait a second, you guys have all this data in metadata fields and it's all structured and I don't have to go figure out like what's what from whom and I don't have to deduplicate it. He was blown away by how much easier his life became writing code because we are data stewards to like the max, put us on steroids and start talking about processing and deduping and across custodians and all that stuff it makes us the geeks we are.
It does. And it's so funny because in our own legal bubble, broader legal bubble, people probably don't think what we do is that sophisticated. But when you start talking to people that are data scientists or talking to Web3 people or blockchain people, blockchain, of course, metadata is very important to blockchain technology. They're instantly like, whoa, you guys work with data like you do. And I think something else we talked a lot about, people think data is easy and it's like perfect and pristine. And I think you and I know that you got to work that data to get it to be to maximize the utility of it pretty much. And
I think that's really true, right? And again, I'm going to go back to the examples of working with data scientists over the last several years and how we've built machine learning models and they don't know our industry, right? So they come in and we're trying to explain things to them, concepts like privileged, you know, what makes a document potentially privileged? And as you say, the nuances of data, for example, we learn pretty quickly that when track changes is turned on Word documents, it's a pretty good indicator that a lawyer might have been involved in,
right?
In the doc. Doesn't make it privileged, but it does mean that, you know, when you float something up to the top of the stack, that you would want to look at attachments where track changes is turned on over, say, PowerPoint or Excel. And so that gets to your point of, you know, really understanding data in the context of e-discovery and in the context of a case, because not all cases are the same.
Right, right. I mean, and I think there's so many challenges to understanding concepts like privilege, you know, using analytics, because historically, the way we've used analytics, machine learning, and e-discovery, it's really been what we would say on the four, based on the four corners of the document. And that's where concepts like privilege and leveraging those tools for privilege can be a little bit more challenging, because a lot of times the privilege flows from maybe a cover email or some level of nuance. And then the whole other challenge of identifying work product privilege, if it's not in the custodial files of an attorney, but it's a business person doing work at the direction of the attorney. That's where I think generative AI can start to become a little bit more powerful, because it does seem to be a much broader umbrella that, you know, it analyzes across multiple documents. I mean, is that kind of what you're seeing in your use of generative AI in e-discovery, Rich?
I don't know that we're far enough along in what we're doing with Gen AI and any discovery. So I'll answer that in a second. But as you were speaking, I was thinking about this issue of how difficult it is to explain every potential privilege that might confer privilege. And then you get somebody to understand it. And then all of a sudden you have to explain non-privileged domains and how something that was identified as privilege that goes out to a non-privileged domain waives privilege.
Or in-house counsel, what hat are they wearing? Compliance person, when does it rise to the level? And I think also privilege is a dance, right? Like you're the position of privilege, while there are rules out there that are guidelines for us, definitions, it varies maybe by the court or the jurisdiction you're in. Delaware, I think, is a great example of that. And then it also varies depending on where you are in the posture of your case. You may be more aggressive in your stances early on, but as you go along, you have that motion practice and those lines may adjust over time. So it is a dynamic concept. It's not like fixed bright line rules. So
It sure is. And the last part of that is, as companies try to train their employees on data security, data safety, data sensitivity, they have to also be careful about training them on what privilege is and what it's not, right? And this issue of silent attorney emails that we've started to see come out of some of the cases where in-house people are copying in-house lawyers and asking questions that aren't necessarily asking for legal advice to try to protect sensitive information. Right. And so back to your question on Gen AI and how all that is going to impact this, is that its ability to do recall and analytics across all that stuff, right? So you could actually use Gen AI to create your data dictionary, to create your coding rules, to create a whole set like they do typically today, where you sit down, as you say, with the four corners and you train review attorneys. You can actually use Gen AI to set up your model to look for all these things and run. It'll figure out, oh, wait a second, I don't need to go any further. Privilege was broken by a third-party domain as soon as this got five deep and whoever forwarded it out.
Yeah. Well, I do want us to dig in a little bit more on Gen AI and e-discovery, but I want to first talk about something that's a more pressing challenge for us. I know everyone's talking about AI, generative AI, but there are other maybe emerging technologies that were emerging 10 years ago that's proving to this day to be very challenging for e-discovery. So You know, that, of course, I'm talking about is text messages, short form messages. E-discovery, for anyone who hasn't listened or doesn't work in e-discovery, it utilizes databases and technology that's structured on a model of a document and an attachment. In essence, modeled off of that paper, letter, and attachment. But as we start dealing with more emerging data sources, text messages, Slack messages, file shares, you know, with links on those on Teams, it becomes increasingly challenging. And we're still, I think, technically dealing with A, how to collect it. And then what often gets forgotten is B and C, how to review it and how to produce it. And I think like we're still struggling with that. I mean, what are you seeing in your practice, Rich?
It's a big problem. You know, new attachments is another term that kind of encapsulates all this stuff. It's a huge problem. I think that the software vendors can do a better job than they're doing in helping us solve this, because as you say, at the end of the day, it's a production issue and what is real utility. And producing TIFF images of inline chats is just, it's not useful. It doesn't really help anybody figure out what people were talking about. It's hard to do sentiment analysis. It's hard to do kind of the things that we all are learning are advanced analytics, whether they come from AI or not, right? So I think it's a real issue. I think we struggle with it as an industry, and I know we're struggling more since the pandemic. I know we've talked about, I've published a survey for the last couple of years on the use of AI and machine learning in e-discovery, and as part of that survey, I've held focus groups with law firms and corporations, and I've done that with ASEDS and Relativity have been co-sponsors of these surveys. And when we did the law firm roundtable this past year, we heard for the first time that the pandemic and the opening up of all tech, right, because we had to. So we're doing video conference now like it's absent a thought. But if it wasn't for the pandemic, we'd still be dialing into speakerphones and screaming at each other.
Right. I worked remotely, I think, a year or two before COVID hit. And then all of a sudden, my conference calls turned into video conferences, even though we had the technology before that. But everyone really wanted to see each other. I didn't quite get it. I am an introvert. So I was just like, okay, I'll dial in, not a problem, you know, I'll video in. But you're absolutely right. Like video conferencing became more common. And I also think there are more clients. So a lot of startup clients might use new platforms like beyond the Microsoft suite. They might use Notion and Airtable and Discord and all of these other sources that it's kind of hard to follow the thread of because people are using them all asynchronously, but kind of at the same time. And it just creates this huge challenge. I know I've talked to some of my friends working in the software companies that you know of, I know. And I said, I would really love for you all to invite some hackers and have a hackathon, like people who know nothing about e-discovery, because we're also tied to this infrastructure, in essence, that table and delivering things on it, like defining things as a document. And it becomes challenging, like short form messages. Again, it can have a three-tiered family relationship. And I'm getting very much in the minutia of e-discovery, but that creates a lot of workflow challenges. It can really, you know, make your brain work extra hard. And if you don't set up a workflow correctly from the front end, like I did, I didn't think about it. I thought this is going to be really efficient right here. And then on the back end, like making it work for a production, it was very challenging. There was a lot of thought I had to put into it to make sure I wasn't screwing something up. So
I'll tell you that, you know, at least 60, maybe 70% of the projects that I've worked on in the last few years, 8 employees is 1 million documents. 8. And it's partly because nobody archives, nobody cleans up their mail, but it's also because of all this data that came out of the pandemic, right? Now we have Teams, now you have short form messages, now you have video, SharePoint. SharePoint was nothing before 10 years ago. Collecting and producing SharePoint sites was not even a big deal. And now you have to do it in almost every single case that you work on. Right?
Yeah.
And once we add in AI created information, which is common, it's going to make it 1,000 times worse. It's going to be a tsunami's worth of data, because if you're using Copilot or you're using something where you're generating content with AI, can you imagine what that's going to do to the, you know, people in our industry?
This is a PSA. Like, anytime I can talk about Copilot in the context of e-discovery, or I have an opportunity to find it into the conversation, right now, Copilot does retain those chats that you have with the chatbot. I think except for maybe in Outlook, but it does it for all of the other Copilots, including Edge. So you ask your Copilot a question, it gives you a response. That all gets retained, aligned with the existing retention settings for your account, and it gets retained in a hidden folder in your mailbox, and it will get collected, and it may not easily be identified or be obvious. And so you may be already collecting chat messages, including, again, Edge. People don't realize that. Like, I don't use Edge for anything personal now, just to be safe, but that, and those are like microcosms of information. And how useful is it?
Recording every screen. It's recording.
Right. That's Recall, correct? Recall. And that's for the Microsoft Copilot laptops, correct?
Yes. And oh my God, I don't want anything to do with it, right? It's a great idea, because how often have we gone, wait, I was on that web page, I can't remember what exactly I saw, and you know, I want to go find it. And now we're back in our browser history, or we're doing crazy stuff because it's not searchable. And this technology records everything you do, everything. And how great to be able to, I've got an index of everything I did today. Are you kidding me? Do you know how big that file is going to be? And do you really want to sit there in a deposition 3 years from now and have somebody ask you, why were you doing this at 10:45 and at 2:30 you were doing this?
Well, and again, it's going to be even more data that we collect. And the data that we collect, it's like getting in smaller and smaller bite-sized pieces. But just because it's small doesn't mean it's easy to analyze or anything. If anything, it becomes more challenging. I'll take an email and attachment any day, but that's really not the world we're living in. While there's a lot, I think, conversation around, AI is going to make our lives easier, maybe AI is going to just balance the scales, because our lives are, as technology advances, at least in the e-discovery world, our life gets more challenging. So maybe the Gen AI will help recalibrate that, so at least things can stay even, maybe better. But I think
we have a good point. I'll go back to the focus groups with the law firms. We were surprised to find out that the law firms were more advanced users of AI than corporations by a lot. Like, they embrace it, they're using it. And you would think, just, hey, flip it, the corporations would be the ones driving AI usage both internally and asking their supply chain and vendors to be more efficient with it. And to see law firms being the early adopters of this stuff is mostly because they don't have a choice. The closer you are to the courtroom, the closer you are to having to find real information that matters, right? And so at the end of the day, you can't depose somebody and give them 10,000 documents. So you have to figure out of whatever they had, out of the 100,000, what are you going to ask them about, right? And that's not something humans can do quickly with the size of data that we have. So I think AI is a necessity, because at the end of the day, its ability to do prediction based on criteria, its ability to learn with or without supervision. We're just starting to understand what that really means, and how lawyers can train the models, or subject matter experts can train models with very little input, right? 1,000 documents reviewed as yes or no on privilege can actually make a model of 1,000,000 documents, so much better. And you do it 6 times, and you've hit recall and precision rates that are acceptable TAR use.
Yeah. Well, and I think like that the important, well, let's just talk about like the funnel of data, talking about the data concepts that we started with. The volume of data you collect, and then over time in the life cycle of data collection and e-discovery on to trial, because e-discovery helps you find the facts or find the data that will help build flat facts that are important for litigation. And it starts broad and it gets narrower all the way to trial. And once you get to trial, you often can only have maybe 100 exhibits at trial, maybe 500, maybe 1,000 if it's a very complex case. But distilling like what's important down to 100 documents, that means those documents go through a lot of iterations of people looking at them and getting it smaller and smaller and smaller. And by the time those documents get to senior associates or partners, that can be a longer road if the volume is very large. But that's the power, I think, of generative AI is it can get the documents to merits counsel much faster, let them have a better sense of what's in there, develop strategy, you know, much faster. And I also think in the context of internal investigations or government investigations, international arbitration, I think there's a lot of power there because it's, you know, you're really just trying to get big picture snapshot, what's there, what's a potential area of risk and things like that.
I think you're absolutely right. You and I have talked about this because we both use Gen AI, right? It's how you prompt, it's understanding that maybe the answer is not what you were looking for, but that you can keep asking and, you know, you can't do damage, you know, in some ways, of course, in some ways you can. But in terms of learning how to prompt, just by using the public stuff that's out there now, because attorneys are, as you say, they're going to want to say, okay, what is the relationship between these documents and these custodians? And have Gen AI go right away, hey, here's what it is. And then if it's wrong, say, or if it's close, but not exactly what you're looking for, knowing how to correctly prompt engineer, right? And you know, prompt engineering wasn't even a job 2 years ago, and now it's a six-figure job. So, I agree with you.
And the beauty of us as e-discovery professionals, we're used to using AI in a way that has to be defensible. We have to document our process. We're not just using AI without putting some rigor around it. So to transition to generative AI beyond machine learning, there is, of course, risk involved. There can be a lack of accuracy or hallucinations, but we assume that anyway as e-discovery professionals. We don't assume the first iteration is going to be correct. We know that we have to validate. So I think it's an interesting and I think potentially opportune time because, again, the data sizes and complexities are going to continue to grow. And we honestly need to be able to dial a friend because life is getting hard out here when it comes to e-discovery workflows.
Yes, that is true. And when you think through Gen AI, and I know we have got vendors in our industry that are about to rolling out Gen AI e-discovery solutions. I'm all for it. I think it's great. You and I seem to share some common concerns about how this has historically been a document by document driven industry and how that's not a model that we see in AI as the right way to go about doing this. Nor do I think you can do Gen AI in one pass on some of the more complicated things like PRIV. Right. But certainly you can use Gen AI to input coding rules and get an answer on a document being responsive. And if it's not responsive, it gives you that answer. And I know you and I have seen what Relativity is doing with error and their error for review. And it's a good use case of how Gen AI works, mm-hmm. right? Because you put in a set of custom instructions and you run through and you're getting answers and you're getting two answers. One is if it's responsive, it's because of this. And if it's, you know, not responsive, it would be because of that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see how our industry doesn't become the leaders of AI adoption inside the legal industry for all the reasons we've talked about. We're data stewards. We understand more than other people the risks of exploding data types and of mm-hmm. people not figuring out like this is going to be a problem for us in 2, 3, 4 years, just as it's a problem now. If you're putting sensitive information into one of the public AI, ChatGPT, you know, Anthropic, Claude, if you're putting stuff in there that you could be violating a protective order, you could be an expert witness who has to be examined in deposition and has to answer why they use generative AI.
Right, right.
Part of the report, right? And the people who think that way are us.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Us and lawyers, but we're the ones who are like, look, this is going to be a problem because, one, you're actually creating a data trail of what you've done that you might not want to have, you know, presented to you in court.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, you know, think about using it. Responsible use of generative AI is very important. But Rich, as an AI visionary, I know you are not just idle and waiting for software companies to roll things out. You're playing with some other tools yourself proactively. I would love to hear you talk about that a little bit.
No, thank you. Yeah, it's one of my passions. Mm-hmm. I do like to develop things. So it goes back to what I just referenced in terms of kind of the architecture of how we think about private language models or private AI applications, right? And you and I have talked about retrieval augmented generation, which is also commonly called RAG technology. And it's a very unique set of tools that allows you to create a private space where you can index and, you know, put information like case information or reports or anything that is subject to, you know, your domain and that you want protected. And when you put it into a RAG architecture, you're actually putting it into a vector database, which I know we're going to get technical here, so apologies in advance, but yeah, ET search it is not. It's actually a way, it's a new way of storing information that is more semantically clustered. And as one of the data scientists I work with likes to say, you're storing data with GPS coordinates. So when you can, when you want to go write code against it and query it, you get such superior analytics. And what we're doing is building private models using RAG architecture for things like expert witness work. I'm working, I think I've told you, I've been working with an executive coach. She's about to publish her 9th book, and we're building a RAG model for her that has all her coaching and, you know, things that are sensitive to her because she doesn't want them to go into GPT or one of the public models. All right, so it's private, it's sensitive, and then you can run queries against it. And again, I'm going to get technical for a second, but the way it generates responses is you plug in one of these models, right? You plug in an open source model or you go contract with ChatGPT so that your data never goes to the public model, your queries never go to the public model, but what you generate back from asking questions does link through so that it has access to the world of data that is the whole library of the internet that these things have. And we're using a product from Databricks that has a RAG architecture and open source plugin models, including one that they've launched. And you can run your query against that. You can run it against Meta's open source models, their small one, their large one. And what we really like about RAG technology is it allows you to identify data sources. If it doesn't have an answer, it says, I don't have enough information in what you've given me to create an answer. And it has the ability to at least give you a sense of whether your answer is hallucinating at all. Right. So we've got it so that we give you all the things I just told you, including a score from a company we're using their software called Clean Lab. And when you run the score, it kind of goes out and says, hey, is this answer a good answer? Or is there BS in the answer? Right. And so you get a score back and it could be a bad prompt, but at least you get an idea of, okay, what are the issues that we know people have as criticisms of the open models? One of the biggest ones is hallucination. They're getting better at citing sources, but I don't know about you. When I click on the source links, I often get dead links or I get taken to a Wikipedia page that's not the actual source, right? And again, when you're building a private model, you can control all that because your sources are what you put in to the vector database, right? And so being able to show people the transparency and to get an accurate result is really powerful. And so that's the architecture, and it's just a couple of use case examples.
Yeah, I think that RAG is incredibly compelling for the legal profession because, in essence, what it does is it takes the LLM as nearly like a starter pack, and then it takes a library of curated data as your expansion pack to really hone in on a level of nuance that you wouldn't get from the LLM alone. So you're working off the knowledge, general knowledge, not that this is AGI, but still for the most part, the LLMs that we're getting are general purpose, right? And we need to, though, refine it for the idiosyncrasies of our profession or for our client or our client's industry. And that's how you do it, is by building those libraries. And that's where data curation is going to be very important. And I think that we're very bad at data curation. And I say this myself, like, not always the best at creating content and then saving it in a logical way that makes sense. But that's really what we should start to be doing, because that's the power of having good, well-curated libraries or well-organized data, is it lets you be able to create those libraries to have a better refined RAG model. So
it's an excellent point, because we don't curate, we don't create in e-discovery, we don't create anything, right? We're given increasingly more complex data problems, but they're data that's already created. So we don't create anything, and we're not curating other content because it's discovery. Hey, this is what we agreed to give you, and that's all you're going to get, right? But a good example of what you just described is expert witnesses, mm-hmm. right? And so expert witnesses rely on a couple things. One is academic research, and then depending on what their specialty is, if they're doing any econometrics, then they're relying on some really, econometric analytics and math formulas that are very complex, especially if you then layer it into something like a big tech case where, you know, the volume of data is billions of records, right? Having the ability to build a private model that says, is there anything wrong with the opposing party's academic research? Is there anything out there that we should know about? And the way you curate and build the model, of course, is you put in all the research that you can find. And then, as you say, as you start getting the starter kits, right, the starter kits are now getting very vertical, domain specific. You can have a scientific LLM, you can have a math LLM. We know LLMs aren't that good at math, but there are LLMs now that are specific science research, specific math. And you plug those in and start saying, what's wrong with the econometric modeling? Is there a better way of doing this? Right. And those are use cases where, you know, I think our industry should adopt that pretty quickly.
I agree. I it's kind of exciting to think about. And the reality is, we have a lot of work on our plates, and we have more work coming in, and there's not an increase in the number of hours in the day. So if we can use this technology to maybe help with an initial draft or to gut check some things, I think there's a lot of value in that.
I agree. I will also add that I think Gen AI has an opportunity in a RAG architecture to significantly alter the sheer number of documents that we're forced to deal with and review. Because going back to the conference that I was at and the term data stewards, right, I saw a presentation where the World Bank is using an architecture to curate, identify, and create metadata out of all their data warehouses in a big data lake. And it's not for discovery at all, right? And as I watched the presentation and the demonstration of what they were doing, I thought, well, wait a second. If you process all your data and store it in a vector database, the utility you can get out of it with some specific training from the case subject matter experts, you ought to be able to reduce the population of potentially responsive documents to something way more precise and manageable. And hopefully in our lifetimes, we could get away from keywords.
I would love that. That would be wonderful.
I mean, keywords, at 40% of all the cases I work on where there's a million documents, 40% of the search term hits for the priv search. I'm sorry, let me re-say that. The search term runs on potentially privileged, like the priv search terms, are returning 40%. Mm-hmm. That's 400,000 documents. There can't be 400,000 privileged documents in a million.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a painful process.
And if we went back to what AI is really good at, which is it sees things we don't see, right? You can train it and it can come back and say, look, these five people had nothing to do with this case. Don't even, you know, like here's the five documents that you really need, and how we get attorneys and judges to stop thinking that keywords is the best way of handling that. This has got to be education. It's got to be the practical cost, right? As the cost of using AI comes down, you can certainly make a burdensome argument that, hey, if you want me to do keywords in the traditional way, it's going to cost my client X because we're going to run through 2 million documents and we're going to filter and filter and filter. And if we use AI, here's the result set. It costs less and it's got a higher precision, right? I want to tell one last story and then you can tell me to stop talking.
No. Go ahead.
It turns out that in cancer, diagnosing cancer, two doctors have to agree that something is cancer before they tell the patient. They're right 80% of the time. One out of five times they're wrong. One doctor in AI is right 95% of the time. So,
wow.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
That's an interesting stat.
It is. So, and think about in the medical profession, it's easier to build these models because people who wouldn't donate their cancer scans to making machine learning, or who doesn't want to participate in solving medical illnesses. In our industry, nobody ever donates the bad emails to science. We're still using the Enron data set because nobody wants to say, here, you can use what I just got in trouble for.
Enron data set.
The DOJ came in and ran a compliance audit on me, and you can have all the data to build your model so that other people will never make this mistake. It doesn't happen. So it's going to come back to us educating people and ultimately winning the burdensome argument with the same kind of reasoning that maybe one lawyer and AI is 95% of something that was 10 lawyers and search terms.
Right. I think the challenge, like not the challenge, but I think the immediate hurdle will be the cost of running Gen AI on like very large swathes of data. Like I think that's going to be a limitation to a certain degree. And that's the value of keywords, is it does kind of make the pool of documents to review a little bit smaller. But I think that we just might be at an interesting transition period where we do have to continue to use keywords because the cost is so high. But, you know, maybe that will change over time.
I will say this, and I've seen this every time we've done this, right? Every time we've built a machine learning model to predict privileged documents, we find privileged documents that don't have any of the keyword search terms for priv, right? We don't find a lot of them, but they're out there. Mm-hmm. And whenever we find them, the lawyers go, how did you find that? Like, it didn't hit on any priv search term. It's the same with responsive, right? That's why there's, you know, famous illusion rate, right? Because we know that keywords don't bring everything that is potentially responsive into your review set.
Right.
These are areas where I think a trained AI model can say, actually, forget the keywords. You're missing 1,000 documents here. You're missing this and this. And, you only need 20% of what you thought your keyword filters were going to be because the actual content of the documents shows the AI. You don't need it, the rest of this stuff.
So. Right. I don't know. It seems like we could be in a world of change, but I think that's
a party when we killed DT search.
Dude, it's the noise words for me. It's the noise words for me that I get hung up. I get the noise words are still there. And I totally get what you're saying. It would be nice to be able to move away from DT search. Totally. But man, the times I've had the noise words, actually having a word that's very important for the case and you not know it. Of course, I like when I see search results back and they're weird, I'm always like, do you have noise words? What are they? Send me the list like now. Or I try to ask that before we even do that. But yeah, it's we can have a party. I agree. DT stands for the person who came up with that. I can't remember his name, but those are his initials.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's funny. Yeah. I didn't know that. This leads to one of my favorite topics, which is ESI agreements and
yes.
how poorly constructed they are and what a mm-hmm. challenge. Everything we've just spent 40 minutes talking about is only exacerbated by the fact that the wrong people are negotiating ESI agreements.
Yeah.
And we're not and at the table. And that's just awful.
Yeah. You know, I think especially you were seeing the hyperlink issue. If you're not aware of that, I've even seen protocols that you have an obligation to disclose if you use analytics, just full stop, not much if it's for culling, but just anytime. And, you know, I would argue what the Sedona principles, like they say, the responding party is best suited to know how to review their documents for production. Yeah. As if you're not cutting docs out or excluding documents, you should be able to use AI to create efficiencies where needed or test and confirm accuracy.
I still haven't seen an ESI agreement that says that they will include e-discovery professionals and mean confers over any technical issues. I just see, if they
we'll actually have a meet and confer.
If they're smart, they say, look, we don't need to pin all this down now. We will meet and confer if something is outside of this, right? I have a client and she said it best. She said they ought to say, I'm going to put a pin in this. We don't know. If you signed an ESI agreement 3 years ago, it would be before Gen AI, right?
And
all of a sudden it's like, well, what are we supposed to do? Well, what you're supposed to do, as we know, is have a meet and confer, mm-hmm. right? And then who's at the meet and confer? Are you? Have you been to
Hopefully.
One?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good for you and good for your firm for doing that. Right. I don't see that as a common practice. And I think it's a major deficit.
Yeah. And I'll even negotiate ESI protocols, be the lead on it. Sometimes I'll work more behind the scenes. But again, it's increasingly important to have people who know the technical pitfalls, because at the end of the day, a court order about e-discovery, the majority of the time it comes down to the ESI protocol. It's spoliation, which is standards there, federal rules of civil procedure and things like that. But otherwise, the format of production, the format of search, like it all comes down to what you had in the ESI protocol and not doing what you agreed to do. Because it is it's an agreement. You probably should have your tech. You wouldn't have someone who's never done appellate law to write an appellate brief. The only appellate brief they ever wrote was in law school. You wouldn't rely on them for appellate advice. So I think we're in many ways, there's a comparable level of nuance and technical understanding there that a general attorney's not going to know.
And I can tell you one of my corporate clients, it drives them bananas that an in-house attorney says, hey, we need to go pull data for this case. And he says, is there an ESI agreement? And they don't have it. And they reach out to outside counsel. And when he sees it, he says half the time he throws up. He's like, who negotiated this and how did this happen? And
Trust me, I've gotten those. I've been brought in later and you're like, and we have to do what? Thank you very much.
Right back to your short messages, right? We have to produce in what format?
But I think you're right. Like, you don't have to have all the answers in the ESI protocol. I think that there's just an acknowledgement of collaboration and negotiation and meet and confer. You're not going to know all the answers there. And I think that that's a great way to address it in a way that I think at the end of the day is the right thing to do. I'm not a fan of
as we're talking, it kind of strikes me that just like the judges have status conferences regularly, there as AI becomes that much more prevalent in all of this, and even as a data type, right? There might be some kind of ESI status conference in a big long tail case, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're going to end up with new types of information, new technology. I mean, we're about to see, we're really at the infancy of natural language processing and AI.
Right.
And what's about to happen,
it's only just beginning.
Yes.
Rich, we have been chatting for a while, but I would be remiss to not close this conversation on a collaboration that we are actually working on together. That's really exciting, wouldn't you say?
I think it's great, yeah. Well, we have the opportunity to educate some European attorneys on how the U.S. legal marketplace uses technology.
Absolutely. So through a common friend, Olga V. Mack, we've been asked to help write a chapter in a publication being edited by two law professors at the University of Turin. And I think we're the only or maybe the only chapter completely written by U.S. Legal professionals. And I know they reached out to Olga to say, U.S. has a pretty robust legal tech practice. We're writing a handbook to help educate young attorneys on the use of AI in legal practice. Help us out. And so we all came together, and that's what we're working on right now.
I know. I think it's so exciting. And I can't wait to do the presentation in Turin in November.
That's right.
That'll be fun. But I will also say, I think that we can actually help, you know, our future friends in the EU, because as we know, their discovery laws are different than ours. Mm-hmm. And they currently don't have to deal with the volume of information that we do. Not that they won't, right? They've got all kinds of stuff that we all have to deal with privacy and how we
collect. Now AI regulations as well.
And certainly they are trying to be the world's leader in AI regulation. Right. And so the more they understand how we use technology in the legal profession here, and the fact that it goes back to we go to trial, we go to court, we go to court on big cases where we've produced millions of documents, which means we have some reason to have to use this stuff. And we're probably more adroit at using it, at least for now, because of the volumes of information and the fact that a lot of the technology is created here. Should be exciting for us to start teaching that to other people. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. And I think also, our use of, again, documentation, while we don't create, we do create, you know, you said something earlier, we don't really create anything, but we do create process related documents about workflow, you know, defensibility binders or SOPs or some sort of case specific notebook that outlines, you know, decisions you might make. So if I were ever to step...
You're giving me bad acid flashbacks to being in process mapping sessions with lawyers 20 years ago.
I love documenting things. Yes.
It's just work on the swim lanes of, you know, the people.
I don't go into that level of polish. You can do a lot with an Excel spreadsheet to track things, which I love. But I think looking, you know, at the EU AI Act, there's risk management systems, quality management systems, you know, there are ongoing obligations that are going to come through for the use of some types of AI systems. And there's a lot that can be learned, I think, from e-discovery professionals in the U.S.
I completely agree. And probably the last thing we should say about that, and I've shown this to you, is taking AI regulations, the EU Act, the U.S. Initiatives, the U.K., we've put them into a RAG system for demonstration purposes so that we can show people that you can start querying, like, how is robotics manufacturing different in the EU with the new act than it is in the U.S. and what the, you know,
Right. Or just definitions, right? Like what types of parties are obligated and how are they defined in the different systems? Now, of course, California, as of the time of this recording, just had 8 new AI acts signed. So it's an ever-growing area of focus. So,
You know what? These are good times to be in tech and to be in our industry. I do think that there's not going to be a shortage of need for people like us.
Yeah, no. I actually was talking to my mom about AI today. I was showing her some of the stuff I was building, like my AI clone. And she said, Cassie, do you think this AI stuff is going to go away? Because everyone talks about how bad it is. And I was like, oh, no. It's not going away. Like, it does need some level of control, arguably. But it's people like me and then, of course, you, Rich, that will be the people that need to help oversee that. So, no, it's not going away.
No, it's not. Anytime. It's not going away. And for the most part, you know, you and I are fans of it, right? It's not bad. It can be bad if it's misused. And certainly,
absolutely,
we've seen enough examples that people need to be careful. On the other hand, if you're not an early adopter of some of these tools and you're in our industry, then you do run the risk of being left behind quickly.
Yeah, it can be stressful at times to want to keep up on top of everything, and you can't really do it completely. But I think at the very least, starting to learn about it, playing with it, maybe a little bit low risk things and maybe free tools just to see, because you do engage with the technology a little bit differently than you would, you know, the traditional internet, you know, or traditional search engine. So
I've told people all the time that one of the easiest ways to get comfortable with it is to have it plan an activity for you.
Mm-hmm.
When I travel, I know this, I do photography. And now wherever I am, I just ask it, can you give me, I was in Seattle, can you give me the right 3 locations to shoot sunrise? And, you know, in what order? And
wow.
It came back and it said, go here, go here, go here. I did the same for sunset. Right? And it gives you a whole map of do this at this time. And if you put in the time of year you're at, it knows, hey, the sunset's going to be at 7:45.
Well, so much to play with. So, well, Rich, we're here at the end. Any, you know, closing thoughts you'd like to share with our audience?
We were talking about Hey Jen. I think that we didn't talk about it on the podcast, but you and I were talking about it before we started. And again, the scary thing is also potentially the great thing, because you can record yourself in your own voice, in your own language, and you can translate it perfectly lip-synced with your voice to over 100 languages and even sub-dialects of languages. And I've been using it, again, in the fun way of, hey, let's, you know, make a thank you, you know, message for somebody in Germany, and I translate myself into German, and it's fun and it's blowing people away. So that's my try Hey Jen.
Hey Jen. I haven't tried it yet, so I need to try it. I will try it soon.
Need to try that, and we also have to say Perplexity is an interesting search engine. So if you want to close on a couple, like, go check out perplexity.ai and Hey Jen, which is HeyGen. You can use them both for free in small quantities.
And then what I've been playing with is Notebook LM by Google, which lets you create notebooks where you can upload specific, either a single document or multiple documents, and it'll kind of synthesize that information into, like, maybe a table of contents or an executive summary timeline. But then now a new feature is it'll create a podcast for you of that content if that would help you learn, because some people are auditory learners and some people are visual learners. So, you know, I think I actually showed that to my mom. I uploaded the Utah AI Act and I was like, Mom, click, wait a few minutes, and then it started playing. And she's like, that just happened. So it's pretty, there are a lot of fun tools to play around with. So
yeah, sure. All right, well, next time we see each other, we'll be in Turin.
That's right, we'll be in Italy. So, well, Rich, I thank you very much for joining me here today. I know I've learned a lot from you, and I'm sure my audience will as well. And to the audience, thank you so much for joining, and join us for the next episode of Cassie and...